This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Resource Center. From working as a CEO of a nonprofit to serving as a presidential nominee in the Clinton and Obama administration, Nishith Acharya, a prominent American philanthropist and CEO of Citizens and the Equal Innovation Institute, is here with us today to speak about his experiences and what it really takes to run a successful enterprise. Nish, I can't seem to wrap my head around the amount of positions they are currently holding. Could you just tell us a bit about yourself? What do you do?
Sure. So my main work is that I am a consulting firm. We have about 8 employees around the world. And we work with corporations, with large foundations, and with governments to develop or improve their innovation entrepreneurship programs. So that's my main work is as a consultant, helping to work like magic, but with corporations and foundations and others around the world. So that's my main thing. But I also like to write quite a bit about foreign affairs and innovation and some of the ongoings there. And so I have a couple of other affiliations for that purpose. One is the Center for American Progress, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C. One is Gateway House, which is a think tank in India. And the other is Forbes, which is a well-known news magazine and media site. And all of those, I write about innovation, entrepreneurship, and the worldwide phenomenon, either public policy or business or things like that. So it is a lot of titles, but it's on the same topics.
Now, what was your experience like? I think also because you're serving as a presidential appointee,
mm-hmm, right.
The Clinton administration.
Clinton and Obama, okay. Yeah.
So what's the experience like?
So it's really an amazing opportunity. In the United States, we have a system where we have a large government bureaucratic class, but then most of the government agencies are run by political appointees. So when I worked for President Clinton, I was very young. And so my work was really, it was logistics, it was media, it was media relations, it was writing press releases and staffing very important people on their trips. When you watch TV, you see young people usually standing next to the politicians and carrying their water, giving them notes, that sort of thing. So I did a lot of that. And that was just amazing. I think it was really a life-defining moment, because what you realize that in many countries, even the most powerful politicians often started from humble roots. And so I think it gave me it was very exciting to do, but also gave me a lot of confidence about big things that I could achieve in this world. Okay. With President Obama, the position was more senior, and I don't know if you want me to talk about that.
Go ahead.
So with President Obama, I came back 15 years later to government, and I was the director of innovation entrepreneurship. And that was really a different role. It was more senior. We were setting policy for the United States. And, it's when you think about it, the U.S. economy really is driven by innovation, entrepreneurship, because the manufacturing has moved to China, the back office services to India. There's so much else that's going Philippines and elsewhere. So, new industries is really where U.S. job growth is coming. And so it's important from a government that we have good policy to commercialize research, to help entrepreneurs access capital, and to help other cities in the U.S. outside of the East Coast and the West Coast, California or Boston, New York, to do well. So I worked on those issues at a high level.
Mm-hmm. So how did that whole passion in entrepreneurship and innovation come from? Mm-hmm. How did you get into that whole space?
Yeah, so I sort of stumbled into it. I think the passion has came later. I think I worked on it. I ran this NGO in the U.S. in the Boston area that developed entrepreneurship education, tech skills and education. And I enjoyed that. But what I really enjoyed is, as CEO of the Deshpande Foundation, which is a large American foundation, we did work on entrepreneurship in rural India, in some in Thailand, some in Singapore, and also in parts of America that weren't doing very well in rural Canada, rural parts of the U.S., New Orleans, as well as at MIT and research universities. And I think that's when the passion developed, because what I found is in the West, it's important because that's where the job creation is coming from. The future of our economy is around innovation and entrepreneurship. So it's really important. But then in my work in India, I found that it's important because that's where the solutions are coming from. For example, for 50 years now, governments have tried to vaccinate children and provide school lunch and teach. And for most parts, it's been, you know, mixed success. There's a lot of struggles still, solid problems of poverty in places like India. And what I see, though, is new innovators and new entrepreneurs coming up with new solutions. And if they can scale those, they can really make an impact. So I think my passion and belief in the sector came from seeing the reality and the need for entrepreneurs to succeed.
And tell us more about Deshpande Foundation.
Right.
I think that's also a part of the idea of how philanthropy and entrepreneurship work hand in hand.
Right. So, you know, there's a time when the private capital is ready to invest in startups. And that's when there's a market that's clear and there's a business opportunity. And then there's a role for government to create the right enabling environment through regulation to make startups successful and you know, for banks to lend to them and for them to incorporate and close businesses, things like that. But there's a middle ground where, you know, we need entrepreneurship training. We need some grants to help new ideas to experiment, not necessarily start as businesses, but before they start to experiment to see if there's a proof of that concept being viable. There's a need for lots of training for entrepreneurs and the skills they need. And so all of that is, I think, well served by philanthropy. And that could be grants from, you know, two NGOs. That could be wealthy families that do it. There's something in between government and in between private investment. And a lot of different people can do that. But I think MAGIC is a government entity, but is doing a good job with that here in Malaysia. So I think that's the place where you need to experiment, take a lot of risk, provide a lot of training, but it's too early for private capital to see a return. And so the Deshpande Foundation was one of the largest foundations in the world that did this. And we tried to do it with social innovation in India for the base of the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And we did it with really high-end research in the United States and commercializing it to be the next biotech companies, the next clean tech, that sort of thing.
Any examples of the works in both U.S. and also in India?
Yeah, so in the U.S., you know, a very good example is there was a company that's now been sold, but they developed a very high-end pipe tubing out of a technology called graphene. And the idea was that it made the cost of transporting oil and gas significantly cheaper, and it was biodegradable and more sustainable for the environment. So, you know, the idea of developing this really complex pipeline material that could save money, be more sustainable to the environment, and more beneficial, and because it was cheaper, also bring it to the rest of the world. That's the type of really complex technology that takes a long time in the lab to develop. But once it's there, it can be a very high-end transformational technology for the oil and gas mm-hmm. industry. So that's the type of thing, you know, anything in data analytics. And then in India, you know, it was programs like one I'm often involved with still is called the Agastya International Foundation, which was an NGO that developed science education for students in India in government schools that, you know, rural areas that don't have a lot of resources. And they we helped them to innovate and try new ideas for the delivery of content and found out that, you know, they were delivering about they had about 25 vans and they were going to rural schools and doing science experiments and teaching and that sort of thing. We gave them money to experiment and try social innovations. And they came up with a breakthrough idea of doing a really, really big science fairs with 10,000, 15,000 students. And that was the viable business model. So now they've actually scaled up to about 7 million children a year in India, one of the largest programs in the world. And that was an example of social innovation coming up, not just with the idea of how to teach, which was the science fair, but that there was a business model that they could scale with government and corporate social responsibility and that sort of thing. So I think it was the same concepts we used, whether it was at MIT or in rural India, to scale ideas. And that's, I think, what was exciting.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think Deshpande Foundation serves as a platform to help scale innovation in different kinds,
exactly.
different parts of
mm-hmm.
the world. And how can we learn from this, so like Malaysia or MAGIC or just entrepreneurship in this region alone? What can we learn from your experience?
Right. So I think for Malaysia, it's important to take a similar two-track strategy. You know, Malaysia is in many ways a wealthy country. It has the wealth, you know, the infrastructure, the income levels of the West to a certain extent. And at the same time, there is the B40, as Magic has been telling me about, who live, you know, who need assistance in Malaysia. And more broadly, if you look at the region, you have India, China, Philippines, Indonesia, with very large base of the pyramid populations that have needs. And so, you know, Malaysia is well suited to develop both. There's a high-end entrepreneurship ecosystem that can develop, that either replicates technologies from you know, the United States for the Asian market, or spins out ideas from its own universities and labs and companies, and spins off high growth, you know, particularly in areas like environment or energy or IT. So there's a high-end opportunity. But then if you look at the fact that there's probably a billion customers, this base of the pyramid in the sort of close spy trade zone within Malaysia, I think there's also a lot of opportunities to come up with solutions in education and healthcare and other areas to reach these communities. And I think the reason Malaysia has that opportunity is because there is the capital here to experiment with some of those things. There's ASEAN and there's strong trade deals, good relations. Mm-hmm. And so there's quite a bit Malaysia can do on both sides of the spectrum. But it'll have to invest in the research, and it'll have to invest in the entrepreneurial training and access to capital and those things.
Okay. Now, in your opinion, how heavily does government aid or policies play a role in the success of startup? Or is there more weight with support from privatized organizations?
Right.
Or maybe like in between, like you said, with the examples of Deshpande? We'll find out more after this. In the studio, we have Nishith Acharya. He's a senior fellow at American Progress and CEO of Citizens and the Equal Innovation Institute. So stay with us. This is Resource Center, BFM 89.9.
Best for money, BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon. You're still listening to Resource Center. I'm Angeline Tay, and today we have Nishith Acharya. He's the CEO of Citizens and the Equal Innovation Institute. He's got extensive experience in terms of driving innovation and entrepreneurship across the world. So today, we want to find out your opinion. How heavily does government aid or policies play a role in the success of startup?
So they actually pay quite a bit, and that's very important that people understand that government is a key factor in startup success. And what I mean by that is, if you look at Silicon Valley or Boston or New York, a very large number of the startups that are there, the baseline intellectual property came from government-funded research. And so the product may not be related to government, and the growth of the company certainly isn't reliant on government. But the government is the biggest funder all over the world of research. And the research is what's leading through the commercial breakthrough. So government has a very important role in funding basic research and supporting it at lots of institutions, government, its own facilities, and universities. And that's mostly around the world what government is good at. Secondly, the underlying playing field and the fairness of the playing field is something government must do. You know, there's a reason the U.S. is the biggest startup market, and that's because the intellectual property rules are very clear and very fair. I mean, people dislike parts of it, but generally, it's a fair system. There's rules for accessing capital that, you know, money banks must and investors must lend to all people, give them a fair shot. The bankruptcy rules are there that are clear, so that if your business fails, you can orderly close it down, but you can also start another business in the future. And you know, these are things that government must set the rules to say, are we giving every business a fair shot to start, succeed or fail, and close, not just the elite or the connected. So I think those are two areas where government is very, very important. And then I think the third is, as you look at economic development of areas where there isn't economic development, that are poor or backwards or have been, you know, lost things because of a change in the economy, can government provide some funds also to jumpstart that? So one of the things we did in the United States is we look at cities like Cleveland and New Orleans and Detroit, and we say that manufacturing is leaving, it's coming to Asia. So how do we revitalize these cities? And what that takes is some government money. It requires some funding for entrepreneurship programs at universities, in the community, some government guaranteed lending from banks to new businesses. So there are multiple roles, I think, for government. But ultimately, government's role often is at the start. Mm-hmm. Once the business starts, I think a lot of it is is up to them whether they'll succeed or fail.
Mm-hmm. So. And I think from the government's point of view is that how much of budget allocation you can put to entrepreneurship mm-hmm. alone, right? I guess it's just how they view the priorities.
Yeah.
15% of MIT graduates in 2014 joined startups in mm-hmm. the Silicon Valley. I read that from your article on the Forbes. Such movement usually trickles around the world, and especially here, we start seeing agencies like Magix being built up. A lot of millennials now are going mm-hmm. into entrepreneurship, starting their own business. What are the trends in the startup industry do you see moving towards at the moment in the States, which you think will sort of move towards Asia as well?
Yeah. So I think the trend in the U.S. And I think it's not a U.S. trend moving here. I think it's the same trends we're seeing at the same time everywhere in the world. So I'm here in Malaysia, and young people and policymakers are talking about the same things that I hear in India, that I hear in Dubai and Kuwait, that I hear in the United States. So it's really a worldwide phenomenon. The first is what you said, that young people want to be control their own destiny. Mm-hmm. They don't want to work for a big company. They don't want to work for government. They want to control their destiny. They see it as more income generation. They also see it as freedom and experimentation. I think also you see at the professional level, whether it's faculty or engineers or doctors, I think you see more of them saying that they want to do something more exciting and they want to be more impactful in their work. So they don't want to just see 10 patients a day. They want to take their learning as a doctor and see if they can reach out to 1,000 patients. And some of that is through NGOs. Some of that is through startups. So I think that culture change is happening everywhere where people are saying, I am empowered and how do I make a bigger impact? And at the higher end, I think you see these structural changes where Americans are saying, no longer is it guaranteed that I'll have a job at this company for 30 years. So I need to be in an environment where I can create wealth as create impact. And at the policymaker level, you're seeing the same thing where people are saying, where is the jobs coming from? Let's support the new ideas. And I think that's going on all over the world. I think here, what you're also starting to see in Asia is this base of the pyramid focus as well, where you look at the large markets in the region and say the customer growth is going to be people living on $3, $4 a day or less. And that's an entirely different level of innovation because the price point has to come down drastically. And it's a different business model in terms of reaching scale. And so, how do you deal with the fact that how do you address Indonesia and Philippines with its geographic challenges of islands and cultures and customs? How do you deal with India and China with just the massive size of the population? But I think there's an excitement that this is 1 or 2 billion customers potentially. And so, instead of selling to people like me and you, just another version of soap, how do we find a way of selling soap to these 1 to 2 billion people? And so I think that trend is really the heart of that is here in Asia.
And geographically, what should startups from countries like Asia, so like India or Malaysia, or just in Asia in general, mm-hmm. Do to reach the scalability of startups in the U.S.?
Well, I think, startups in the U.S., they haven't necessarily – I think in IT, it's very easy to reach scale. And so I think there's some sectors where Malaysians can say, particularly IT, there's a sort of Asia-centric market where they can quickly achieve the same level of scale. I think in other sectors, it's more complicated, like clean tech or manufacturing. And I think one of the differences between the U.S. and Asia that way is two things. One is the venture capital markets. And so Asia does need to develop venture capital at all levels. So there's, I think, a good angel funding sector here in Asia, but there's not the larger institutional funds that are putting in $100 million or $50 million into high growth companies. They're not yet seeing they're considering that too risky. So I think that's where the U.S. has a big edge is these larger funds that are willing to invest.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that has to be done in Asia, I think, is the management level. So Asia is full of really, really good managers in big companies. From Korea and Japan through Southeast Asia to India, good at big companies and that sort of thing. But running a 500-person company and helping to build it to, 5,000, there's not as many managers who have done that. Or even 50-person startup to a 500-person startup. There's that middle management is missing. And so Asia will need to develop that capacity to have CEOs who can raise, $50 million in capital, build a company from 50 to 500, and then take it global and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And that's the second area where I think there needs to be development where the U.S. is ahead.
Now, what do you think will be the biggest change moving forward in Asia?
I think it's going to be a culture change.
Culture.
I think you know, and again, having worked in India and elsewhere, we are very conservative by culture in terms of jobs and that sort of thing. And so, you know, there's always a desire to have a nice graduate from college, have a nice job and move forward. In addition, there's a real fear of failure. I think in Silicon Valley, you know, failure is accepted, particularly assuming all things are ethically correct. You know, if you fail, but it was done because the product was too early for market, or, you know, you were a bad manager your first time around, you're given a second chance. I think across Asia, culturally, that's very difficult. The, you know, whether it's the bankruptcy laws or, you know, the family concerns or all of this, I think that's been the problem in terms of people going on to startups. But now, with the younger generation, I think you're seeing change. They're connected globally. They don't care as much about the, you know, sort of the older ways, and they're willing to experiment. And I think there's enough jobs that there's, you know, if they fail in their startup, they can actually still go get a job in the private sector. So I think you're seeing that culture change around experimentation and taking control of ideas, you know, rolling up your sleeves and doing it. That's relatively new in this part of this world. So,
all right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking to Nishith Acharya. He's the CEO of Citizens and the Equal Innovation Institute. And you've been listening to Resource Center, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.